Hey, hi, and welcome to Reform Tennessee. I'm Brittany Hodge, and I'm joined by my lovely co-host, Lauren White.
Hello.
Hi, Lauren. I'm so excited for this episode today. How amazing was it to kind of have Tanya and Rachel in the studio to talk workplace culture?
I felt like this was an incredible first conversation to have.
Absolutely.
What a way to kick off season two. I just left this episode feeling really thankful for the wealth of insight that these women brought to the table. And I think whether you're just starting out or a seasoned professional, it really transcends all generations.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what a power duo. This is like the pantheon of like empowered women that are just trailblazing sort of our little architectural ecosystem.
100%.
So if you don't know Tanya Spry, she's the director of human resources at Nashville's very own Gresham Smith. She has over two decades of dedicated leadership and sort of fostering employee cultures and building really fabulous HR programs and initiatives with a lot of different kind of architecture and engineering firms. She also serves on the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging Advisory Committee at Gresham Smith.
Yeah, she brings such a wise perspective, not only on workplace culture, but on really important aspects, including equity and inclusion within a firm at a large scale.
Yeah, it was fantastic. We also have Rachel Gresham. She's, to me, just an absolute national treasure, very good friend of mine. She's a young architect and senior director of professional practice programs at AIA. Rachel has this really unique background in that she kind of has practiced architecture for the last decade and has recently sort of made a transition to her role at AIA National, where really she's kind of helping support architects more than necessarily being one all the time. Rachel has sort of this great passion for workplace cultures, life balance, practice management, and all those DEI imperatives. She also co-founded the EDI committee at AIA Middle Tennessee and has served on the board of directors as well. She's super involved in our little community.
Rachel really seems like a true advocate for architects at every stage of their career. And her contributions are shaping the future of our profession, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And having Rachel on the podcast today is a testament to her willingness to share her knowledge and bring up the next generation. And I'm certain listeners will walk away inspired by her insights.
Absolutely. You know, today as we talked with Tanya and Rachel on workplace culture, we really wanted to focus on the AIA Guides of Equitable Practice. If you aren't familiar with this document, please, please, please do yourself a favor. Go explore it, read it. It is just a wealth of knowledge, fantastic resource, and it really even transcends our industry to talk about how anyone and everyone can be more equitable. Please enjoy Workplace Culture with Tanya Spry and Rachel Gresham. Tanya, Rachel, welcome to the podcast. We're so excited to have you today for being in our little cozy space. Well, we're so excited to have you on, I think, for a plethora of reasons. But I think what really stood out was sort of your extensive history and experience, but also like your passion for kind of this idea of workplace culture and also diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace and sort of how those two things tie together. It's so important to us in the subject of this podcast. Tanya, I think you really stood out to us sort of, you know, as the director of human resources at Gresham Smith, you sort of have this perspective of like 30,000 feet, I think maybe, where you kind of get to see sort of what's going on in these large firms and you're not an architect, which is also a really great perspective. And then Rachel, you know, you're sort of like the boots on the ground for the last, you know, decade. You've really been working in the practice and have gone back, got your MBA and did some really, really great research on sort of organizational structure and how that affects culture. You've also been kind of a workplace advocate in some of the places you've worked. So we really think that both of y'all bring such an interesting, cool perspective, and it's going to be such a great dynamic duo.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So to start us off, I kind of want to hear, you know, a little bit about both of your passion for these subjects and sort of understand maybe who you are as individuals and leaders. So I kind of want to ask you both to describe yourself kind of as a leader in three words and maybe expand on why you picked those three words.
The first word that comes to mind for me is transparency. And the reason for that is a lot of times as leaders, We try to protect our team from the politics going on behind the scenes or the back and forth and getting to a decision. And when we're not transparent, you know, there's sometimes a lack of commitment or buy-in because they don't understand the steps in the process to get to that decision. And so I always try to be very transparent with my team and let them know what's going on, let them know when there's roadblocks or challenges or what's going well. So when it comes time to implement a project or initiative, they kind of understand what has happened along the way and they have that commitment and buy-in. The second word is humble. And I always say I'm definitely not the smartest person in the room. But when you're in a leadership position, sometimes you can forget that and you can get a little full of yourself. So I always want to remind myself to stay humble and remember kind of where I've come from and all the steps it's taken to get there.
I love that.
And then the last one is empathetic. That is so important to me because we always want to try to pull strengths out of our team. And if you're not understanding where people are coming from and that they have differences and appreciating that diversity of your group, it's just really challenging to be effective as a leader. So that empathy in whatever an individual may be going through or whatever their background is important.
I love those three. That's just fantastic. I couldn't have picked a better three myself, especially kind of, you know, and I didn't really think about this, but for your position, especially, I mean, with HR, transparency is huge. So I love that you picked those. Rachel, what about you?
Yep. I was getting ready to say the same thing where it's like so encouraging to hear those three specific words come from a chief HR leader. So awesome. And your last one is a great segue to my first one, which has to do with competencies or strengths. As a leader, I want to make sure that I'm focused on the competencies and strengths of my team and myself, and that I'm fostering those in folks and not forcing them to push a skill that's a weakness of theirs to try and make it mediocre, but really focusing on the things that they're really great at and pushing them even farther into using those strengths to become core competencies that they can use to market themselves and help them move up in their career. My other word is self-awareness. This goes along with strengths, and that the self-awareness of your own strengths is such great information when you're leading other human beings. If you're aware that you have certain strengths and also certain weaknesses, the combination of those two goes a long way, and you can ask for help when you need it, and you can take on challenges that you know you can rise to the occasion. And then the last word I have is a little bit more personal to me, and it's intentionality. I like to say that my career is a chess game, and I'm always looking to put the chess pieces on the board in a way that's going to set me up for success in the long run. And that's always changing based on the things I'm good at, based on the folks that I know, based on the positions that I'm in, based on the projects that I'm working on. And I think that applies outwardly as well. I'm always trying to poise my team to be successful and always trying to move them along in a way that we can make it to the finish line and finish strong every time.
That's amazing. Love those three. You know, I feel like I was kind of leading in this question in terms of talking about workplace culture, because the truth is that we really need leaders who have these qualities. And I love that you're both in this room to speak to this. It kind of starts at the top and it really trickles down pretty quickly. And if you do not have a leader who is there to support the culture that you really need, I mean, the likelihood of it, you know, trickling down to you, it's not a great, you know what I mean? The likelihood is not good. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great way to kind of start this conversation about workplace culture. When I kind of think about workplace culture, I'm honestly pretty overwhelmed at sort of the amount of understanding and work that it really takes to make a successful culture. You know, pizza parties and ping pong aren't really doing it for people anymore in 2024. It's not cutting it. You know, it truly affects every way we think and act sort of in relation to our work. And we have to really dig in and think about how we're nurturing it and managing it. We have to sort of really question these sort of assumptions and responses of that's just how we do things. I think that's a really dangerous statement. And I mean, especially when it comes to sort of positive and inclusive work environments. So I'd kind of love to hear from both of you. What's your view on workplace culture? Why does all of this matter? Why is it important?
Workplace culture is so important because it's such a huge factor in your satisfaction at your job. You spend 40 hours a week, more than likely you spend more than 40 hours a week in an environment that is going to have a major impact on your daily life and on your family. And I always like to say, there's no such thing as work-life balance. It's just life balance. Trying to think about those as dichotomous is a mistake. It's important, especially to emerging professionals, because a great workplace culture is going to nurture you in a way that's going to help you grow really quickly. Workplace culture, to me, too, we have to be careful that we're not looking at it at a surface level. So what I explored during my MBA was these underlying systemic causes of what leads to a workplace culture. And it's more than just, you know, how you're interacting on a daily basis. These things are layered with how your organization is structured. Is it hierarchical? Is it flat? Those all have an impact on how your human beings are going to interact with one another. And so I like to take a deeper look at workplace culture from the root cause of where those interactions are coming from and then the humans interacting within it.
Absolutely. Agree with everything you said. Workplace culture is everything. That's my opinion. I feel it's so important. Yes, it impacts engagement, which is huge, but it also impacts, you know, we always say, hey, you spend more time with the people you work with than you do with your family a lot of times. And so having a positive culture that you buy into is so key when you are spending so much time in that environment. But it not only impacts how individuals at your company feel, it also impacts externally how you're showing up to clients, the communities, especially in our industry. We have such a significant impact on our communities, and that workplace culture is impacting all of those things. So it's important that people understand what that culture is and that they buy into it and enjoy being in that workplace.
Yeah. And it's that recruitment retention layer of it too. Gallup is constantly reporting that workplace culture and the quality of the environment is just continuing to rise in the priority list of folks that are looking for a job, especially after COVID and the pandemic and with the return to work. It's more important than ever.
Well, and I will say, since COVID, employees expect more out of the workplace culture. If they are going to show up in an office and make that effort, then they want to enjoy while they're there. Absolutely. If not, they would just rather be at home. So you have to have a good culture to encourage people to want to be present and engage with each other.
Yeah. Tell me, what about coming to work is better than staying in my pajamas all day?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to like kind of the retention aspects and all of that, I mean, firms can lose candidates, employees, productivity, trust, respect. I mean, you can lose so much, but think about you also have to really consider how much you can gain by really creating that really great culture for people to be a part of. I mean, we're all humans. We're all people that make up these organizations, and we should be happy and excited to be in them. And we should be ultimately doing our job, which is serving clients and also making sure that they're a part of that culture at some point. So that's great. Thank you both for those awesome answers. So architecture kind of has this well-known, very well perpetuated, flagrant cultural stereotype. Sort of has this romantic facade of this studio culture, I think. And it has all these sort of issues like chronic burnout, extensive personal sacrifice that I think we're finding a lot. And it's sort of become normalized, I think, at some point. Mm-hmm. And so looking at the AIA guides for equitable practice, there's a really great diagram in there that talks about architecture's cultural iceberg and kind of, you know, like an iceberg, you see the sort of the small tip of it that's poking above the surface. And what we see in architecture and sort of the scene and shared culture that's really easy to point to, that I think even people outside of architecture may be familiar with, is that, you know, we're sort of known for sketching and modeling and drawing. We dress in all black. We wear cool glasses. We have these studio environments that are, you know, this open space with tackable surfaces and materials and books and all these things. But kind of what's underneath the surface that we're not really seeing. And it's sort of these attitudes and expectations and stereotypes and assumptions about architecture. You know, I think that we sort of distinguish ourselves as working class laborers. We really attach status to education and programs and where those are from. And then we really value opportunity and achievement sometimes more than we do income, which is a huge problem. And I think we have a little bit of a martyr complex when it comes to sort of work ethic, where personal sacrifice becomes necessary. So that's sort of some of the big ones that stood out to me in terms of this sort of perception of kind of what's falling underneath that surface. I'm really interested in hearing from both of you kind of what stands out about that iceberg.
There were so many things that stood out to me and that resonated. And I thought, oh, I've witnessed that. I'll pick a couple. One was commitment. Generational differences have become a huge topic in the workplace. And under commitment, it talks about being available when needed, which may mean at all hours. It talks about taking advantage of flexible workspace options. And there's been a lot of conversation of certain generations maybe not being willing to work a ton of hours over 40 and questioning that commitment. So I think we have to shift our mindset to realize it doesn't mean they're not committed. Or if you have a working parent who flexes their hours so they can leave early to go to a baseball or sporting activity, it doesn't mean they're not committed. And so shifting that mindset to make sure that we are appreciating what they're bringing to the table and recognizing it's okay if they're not working until 10 o'clock at night and that they have that, I know you said life balance, so mm-hmm. I'll use that. Mm-hmm. And then the second one that stood out to me is race and ethnicity. And that's something that we have been focused on as well because, you know, we need a more diverse workforce in the architecture field. And we're trying to engage at an early level with middle schoolers, high schoolers to educate them and make them understand the options when it comes to what architecture is and what opportunities there are for them. And so it's our responsibility to really engage at an earlier level so that we can get more youth interested in our industry.
Absolutely. It's not a known profession necessarily out there for a lot of young kids, and especially in disadvantaged areas. And so it's so important to make that impact early and often.
Absolutely. I grew up in a small town, and architecture or engineering or any kind of STEM-related profession was not talked about as I grew up. So that's not a profession that I thought of going into. And of course, I'm not now. I'm in human resources, but it's really about helping them understand that there are options out there and that they can achieve those professions as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. I love how you touched on that pipeline, Tanya, and that pipeline does start very early on. And I feel like I'll talk from personal experience. I had just the great luck to grow up next door to an architect, and his wife was an interior designer, Mr. and Mrs. Bolt. They were sort of a third set of grandparents of mine. And I remember him making me a dollhouse out of foam core at a very early age. And when I told him that I was going to be an architect when I grew up, he said, "I'm going to chop off your hands." Which, what a wild story. And like his gut reaction, really, you know, like to have someone who has been an architect for such a long time hear a young person, especially a female, say that they want to be an architect. And then his gut reaction is, "I'm going to cut your hands off so you can't draw, so that I'll choose something different." I mean, I think that says a lot about the pipeline that he knew was the future he knew was coming for me if I committed to this profession. All jokes aside, it's still a wonderful profession to be in. And then in high school, I had access to drafting classes, which not everybody has access to those. So I was in a privileged area where that was something that my high school could offer. And then we also had engineering classes and architecture design classes to go on top of it. And then I lived 30 minutes away from Virginia Tech. So I was very lucky in that I was exposed to it at an early age, but not everybody in the nation has that privilege. I think that's why programs like ACE Mentors are so important. The Nashville chapter is really active. They have 10 teams. Anybody who's listening that's looking to foster that pipeline, check out ACE Mentors. It's a great way to foster that pipeline. And then I can touch a little bit on commitment too, because I think from the architect practice perspective, it's such a slippery slope. And Brittany, you mentioned martyrdom, and I use something a little bit more, has a little bit higher imagery of, you know, handcuffing yourself to your desk for the sake of a deadline. We are notorious for saying things like, oh, you don't get into this profession for the pay, you get into this profession for the cause and the things that you can contribute to the community. And I think that's true. But we have to be careful that we don't let that get in the way of living healthy lives. And I think the generations that are coming up, the young folks that have watched older generations sort of sacrifice themselves for their job and stay in one workplace for 20, 30, 40 years, they're seeing that and saying, you know, I'd like something a little different for myself. I'd like to be able to go home at the end of the day and enjoy my dog, or I'd like to be able to, you know, leave for the weekend and go canoeing and not feel like, you know, I'm going to be facing, you know, hell when I get back to my desk on Monday. And I think they're just making choices and making different priorities based on the things that they've seen. And again, it doesn't mean that they're not committed. It just means that their priorities are a little different. And I hope that our profession can start to adjust to those priorities. And everybody wants things faster, more complete, more details. It's an impossible circle to square at the end of the day. And we're asking our young folks and our emerging professionals to prioritize, you know, some impossible lists of tasks and things.
But it can be difficult. It can absolutely be a piece of culture that is kind of created in places. I mean, it starts in school, right? Are we sort of taught right at the onset that good architecture has to come from struggle, that you kind of have to do, you have to self-sacrifice and do all of these iterations and things to be able to come to a successful design at the end of the day, or whatever it may be, or to deliver a successful project? At what point are we being kind of educated to devalue our time and sacrifice ourselves? It's really important that I think people recognize maybe when we're sharing that culture a little bit and understand how to manage it or to mitigate it.
Yeah. Tanya, I'm really curious what advice you might give to a young person that is struggling to sort of reconcile that. Like, they want to be committed, they want to show that they're a team player, but they also want to make sure that they're not on a fast track to burnout like so many of us have experienced. And, you know, balancing the expectations of their team leaders and their firm leaders, and, you know, that maybe they're an ambitious person that really wants to move up and has the talent, but still doesn't want to be burnt out by overworking themselves.
I think it's a lot of what you talked about earlier, that self-awareness and recognizing if that pressure is being put on you, and developing a good relationship with your supervisor so that you can have those tough conversations and explain, I am fully committed. I don't work well when I have to work 50 hours a week. I'm not at my best. I'm at my best when I can work an 8-hour day, go home, decompress, and come back refreshed tomorrow. You're going to get more out of me. So kind of explaining the why behind it and reassuring them that you are committed to your role and your profession. And it's not about the number of hours. It's about the quality.
Totally. That's great advice.
Are there other kind of cultural aspects that stand out to you that maybe folks are struggling with, or symptoms that stand out that you can kind of easily spot maybe when a culture is falling short?
I want to speak really positively about some cultures that I've been a part of. And just in contrast to some of the other ones that I've been a part of, I was fortunate enough early on in my career to experience three very different work cultures very early on in my career. I changed firms three times in the first 3 years of my career, which is kind of unheard of. But also the advice I would give related to that is when it comes to work culture, you might not get it right the first time and you might not find that perfect fit right away. And that's okay. My most recent architecture practice experience, I came from a learning culture. I came from a culture where everyone really cared about fostering the folks underneath them. They saw that the more they could teach the young architects coming up, the more value that was brought to the client, the more skills these folks learned very quickly in order to move up in their careers, to become more valuable to the firm. You never met someone that you asked a question to that would turn you away. Everyone was celebratory of curiosity and wanted to help you and wanted to learn. Some of my favorite mentors came from that environment. I think when it comes to identifying a culture that might be falling short, it does have a lot to do with maybe the attitude that you're given when it's time for you to ask for help or it's time for you to grow. And if folks are totally on board with that and willing to help you and escort you through it, no matter what it might cost them in terms of time, I think that's a red flag that I would point out.
I think one of the biggest struggles is people don't understand what the culture is, because so many times leaders stand up and say, we have a great culture or we're aspiring to have a great culture, but what does that really mean? And so it's important that you're defining that for your organization and for your leadership and making sure everyone understands what you're aspiring that culture to be within your company. And also the second piece is making sure you're getting buy-in, that commitment. If the employees are not buying into what you're saying the good culture is, then you may need to make a shift. And you may need to do that quickly, because that is such a key piece of having an effective culture, is to have that buy-in.
I totally agree. And I do want to point out that the size does not matter in that advice you just gave. Whether you're a small firm, medium-sized firm, large firm, is completely scalable. If you've got a smaller firm, it's still important to have stakeholder engagement, just as a large firm might seek out through a survey what their stakeholders believe too. And you do kind of have to go put boots on the ground and ask folks. And making assumptions as a leader about what your employees might want, that's a slippery slope too.
Well, and I would add to that, in larger firms, it's defining it at a high level, but also being okay with different size offices. If you have a multi-office organization, they have microcultures, and that is okay, because you're naturally not going to have the same culture in an office of 200 people as a 10-employee office. Right. And so being accepting that there are going to be some differences across various locations when you're spread out like that. Mm-hmm. And even within studios, within a larger office as well.
Yeah, it's true. I think this is a good time to point out one of the statistics that we were talking about before we started recording, which is like 75% or some wildly high number like that. 75% of your satisfaction of your job depends on your manager. And that does point to microcultures on projects, microcultures within studios. And I think that's something that as a young person looking for a job, you might overlook during the interview process. So it's important to ask about those microcultures too when you're interviewing.
Well, and it's important to also get to know who you'll be reporting to really well during that interview process.
Right.
Because a lot of times you're interviewing with a team and you don't spend as much time with the person that you may be directly reporting to. And so it's okay to ask for additional conversation with that person to make sure that you connect with them and can work effectively with that individual.
Yep. I give that advice for sure. And I also build on that and say, ask to talk to your peers too. Ask to talk to the people that you'll be in the trenches with and ask tough questions of them. And they might be able to give you a good idea of working with that manager as well.
Absolutely.
What other things kind of stand out to you about sort of what makes a positive, strong, healthy workplace culture? Is there something maybe
that you personally prioritize or find really important?
That's changed for me a lot over the last couple of years. So I have about 11 years of experience in the industry now. And when I was fresh out of school, it was all about, are there growth opportunities? Will I be nurtured? We all come out of school and a lot of us are kind of let down by what the profession offers us immediately after we graduate as architects, in that it's not like school a lot. It's a lot more execution of work, construction document work. You know, you're not going to get in front of stakeholders and clients immediately. You kind of have to earn that trust. You have to earn that foundational knowledge before you can move forward. And for me, it was, what's the attitude towards younger folks? What's the attitude towards emerging professionals? Is it, you know, we want to teach them, we have mentorship programs, or we have excellent mentors, or medium to large firms, do they have regular ways to engage with their young folks and teach them something new? It was all about learning. And it's changed for me just in recent years as I've shifted from being an emerging professional to, you know, mid-career. I would say I would look for different things. Can I tell you exactly what those are at this moment? No, I'm still figuring it out. But now I'm in a position to make sure I'm offering the things that I think are important to the young folks. And I'm still sort of defining what's important to me in a culture going forward, because I'm in a different position now.
I think that's so true. I mean, what we need out of a workplace definitely changes throughout our careers. And so that's why it's important to have a very diverse culture as well, where there's something for everyone in the different phases of life or different backgrounds, whether it be culturally or in another area. And so one of the things that we really focus on at Gresham Smith is having servant leadership, because as a leader, you are not there to serve yourself. You are there to serve your team. And so we really put that as a priority as we're interviewing or looking for the next level leaders in the organization. And that's important, as well as respect. And I say respect at all levels. Our executive team encourages, they sit, we have an open space environment and they sit out with everyone else. They encourage people to reach out to them and they're very responsive to that. So I think that type of leadership is important.
Yeah, it's really important to be kind of in tune with what your leadership style is. You mentioned servant leadership. Understanding kind of what your style is, yeah, is really important, because just like some of the conversation we've had, I mean, a lot of times people don't quit jobs, they quit managers. And how can we be better managers? I think leadership happens at every stage of your career, whether it is your first day or your last day. In some way, you're a leader. There's some skill that you're bringing to that workplace that other people may not have, and they're going to look to you to help support their own skill set. So I think leadership is so important, even if you don't think you're a leader.
Yeah.
You absolutely are.
And everyone is a leader in some type of way.
Amen. And I want to speak to the small firms real quickly about some of Tanya's reflections, because sometimes I think we make a mistake that if we're in a small firm that some of this doesn't apply to us, or some of these ideas that are a little bit more applicable to large firms don't apply to us. And I think we have to be careful there, because as a small firm, we're equally as responsible for offering a culture that is positive and nurturing. And that can also be hard when, you know, a large firm might be able to offer someone a career-long position where they can offer nurturing learning and resources throughout someone's career. And as a smaller firm, you might think, well, what I really need right now is someone with, you know, 0 to 5 years of experience to help me get some work out the door. And I don't necessarily need to take on some of these more nurturing roles or think about offering some of these resources. And I want us to be careful with that, because you never know where your small firm might go. But then on the other side of that coin, it's A-OK to offer yourself up as a stepping stone if you're only ever going to need someone with limited experience and you don't have the space in your firm to help people grow, it's not unhealthy that you can't offer that. What's healthy is that you're going to let that person know when they're interviewing. You're going to be very open and honest with them that they might reach a level of growth where you have to help them find what their next step is. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with being transparent about that. But if you can offer them growth opportunities up until that point, and you can promise them that you're going to teach them everything you know until, you know, they outgrow you, and then help them to their next step, that's the ticket. Keeping someone down or not teaching them something new because you simply just don't need them to do it, that's where you have to be careful that you might be offering something a little toxic.
Well, and I think that's so important, is not overcommitting in interviews. Mm. Because there's no quicker way to disengage someone, and not only they're not contributing their best if they feel like you haven't been upfront with them in the interview, but also, you know, there are so many situations where you have boomerangs, and because circumstances change in firms, and you wouldn't want to create a negative relationship with that individual if there would be a chance of them coming back eventually.
Absolutely.
And so I would just say never try to oversell the position in an interview.
Undersell, overdeliver.
Always.
A good mantra.
Yeah, I think too, when it comes to sort of being in a small firm, if the culture isn't exactly what you're looking for, or if you're not getting something out of that environment, there are other places to look. I mean, if there are programs and things about culture that you're looking for, there's a ton of really great organizations locally and nationally that do have those programs that you can be a part of. You can find mentors outside of your firm. You can find emerging professionals, contemporaries, and friends in other places. And so it's kind of having that self-awareness to go look and to understand and find where you can fit in, and more than maybe just your workplace, but also in your community.
Yeah.
Well, and I always tell people, you are interviewing the firm as much as the firm is interviewing you.
Amen.
And you don't have to take the position just because it's offered. Especially, I think that's good advice for emerging professionals that are excited. But I think the younger generations are getting very well educated on that, because I see more and more that they're shopping around and making sure that they're choosing what's the right fit for them.
Mm-hmm. And I think what we also have to be aware, and advice I might give to an emerging professional that's coming up right now, is some of this ability to kind of select and interview a firm does have a correlation with the economy. So when there are a lot of people hiring and there's a lot of jobs on the market, there's a lot easier, mobility is a little bit easier. If you don't like an offer you're given, there might be something on the other side that's a little bit better. And then when the economy is down, those opportunities may not always be so plentiful, and being able to have the privilege of choice might start to disappear. And those things are cyclical. And I think it's just important to understand that when the economy is good, you have better choices. When the economy is down, you know, buyer beware. And the ability for a firm, especially maybe a smaller mid-sized firm, to invest in, and you can let me know if this is true about large firms too, Tanya, the ability to invest in cultural initiatives when the economy is not so great, sort of go down. Those are the first things to get cut often. And just being aware of that too, when you're shopping around for a firm.
I think in some firms, yes, some larger firms, I wouldn't say that's necessarily the case for all.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on how much value that firm puts on culture. While some of the things may be cut, it might not be the first thing to be cut. Mm-hmm.
That's encouraging to hear.
How has your personal background and identity kind of influenced your experience kind of within the workplace and the culture of it? Is there like a specific moment that you can really think of where you felt really supported or maybe really challenged that really made you step back and think, whoa, this is important to me? And how did that experience kind of affect you in the long run?
I don't think I have one. I have so many.
Sure.
I mean, I feel like, as far as personal background, grew up in a small town on the Alabama-Tennessee state line. and had really hardworking parents. And so that definitely defined who I am. My dad worked in manufacturing, and I remember I was about 12 years old, and he said to me, find a job where you can use your mind and not your hands. And that really resonated with me. He said, stay in school. And he just always pushed me to do that. So I think that hard work and seeing how my parents grew up really impacted where I am today. As far as a specific moment in my career, again, there have been so many. I feel like I'm challenged all the time, which is great. And it's why I stay in human resources, because I do like a challenge. And I guess if there's one defining moment, and maybe because it's recent, it sticks in my mind, and that's COVID.
Yeah.
From an HR professional, that was a very challenging time, because we are responsible for caring for employees, ensuring that they feel security, and no one felt secure when everything shut down. So no one was sure as far as if they were going to be laid off, if they would have a job the next day. And that empathy I talked about earlier really elevated during that process.
Yeah, and it's so many varying levels of concern. Some people had very little concern. Some people had a lot of it. And so kind of meeting people where they were at, I'm sure, was a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And determining who could actually go into the field, because a lot of cities were shut down. So it was an interesting experience that I will never forget, I have to say.
I'm glad we're past it.
Absolutely.
I can talk about one defining moment, but I think just for me, when work culture became front of mind and a priority and something that I was really passionate about advocating for, is just the culmination of experiences that I had across the three different firms that I was able to experience early on in my career. I had great experiences, I had not so great experiences, and I was just able to see a full spectrum of what it could be like to exist in a corporate culture super early. And ultimately, you know, I realized that a lot of these cultural aspects are industry specific and not firm specific. So I think something that I learned early on is the grass is not as always greener on the other side. And a lot of these things that we struggle with as a profession are just so pervasive that you're going to find them wherever you are. So that was sort of the impetus of me going back to business school. I realized that we have to be able to invest in work culture. We have to be able to invest in our people. And in order to do that, we need to get paid more for the value of our services as architects. So wanted to go to get my business degree so that I could figure out how we could do that, and how can we sort of throw the wrench at this root problem. Have we asked ourselves why enough times? Have we gotten to the bottom of, you know, why can't we invest in these things? Why does it seem to be such a struggle for so many to invest in these things that are so important? Especially to recruit and retain people, you know, from the pipeline that we were talking about earlier. We do have an issue of inviting people into our profession, and then they realize that, oh, this isn't for me. And then, like a lot of women, they get to the childbearing age and it doesn't make any sense for them to stick around. And, you know, I'm referencing Rosa Shang's 32% from her research a few years ago. Again, a recent example for me, that's why it's sticking out in my head too, is just the sheer burnout that I experienced when I was working full-time as an architect and going to business school on the nights and weekends. Even if I hadn't been going to school, the work that I was doing on a daily basis was extremely demanding. I felt like I was never caught up, always felt like I was falling short. And while projects were moving forward, it was just the deadlines were just getting more aggressive, and the things that our clients expect us to include in a drawing set, you know, the more technology we have access to, the more things that they want us to draw on the paper. And that's a whole risk management box that we probably shouldn't open today. But on the other side of this burnout, having transitioned to working for the American Institute of Architects, I'm just experiencing a completely different speed of how to operate in a corporate environment. And I have to say, the feeling that sticks out to me the most on a daily basis is just how exhausted I continue to be, how I'm continuing to have to rewire my brain and my neurons and my thought paths to, you know, remember that, like, I'm not, you know, clenching all the time. I'm not stressed out all the time that I can breathe. And when I get home from work at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday, that I can relax. And so if I knew how much effort it was going to take to recover from the burnout, I would have tried a lot harder to not get that far down that road. And I don't even know how I would have done that in the moment. I have no idea what I would have done differently. It goes back to the expectations at work as a project manager and, you know, what has to get done. And some of it's project expectations, some of it's cultural expectations. You know, I think staffing is a really important thing that contributes to culture. And, you know, sometimes I felt like my projects didn't have the right energy on them. And, you know, some weeks they did or some weeks they didn't. And it's a challenge to balance it all and recognize that your firm leaders really are doing the best that they can. To a certain extent, there's not anything that you can do other than survive in certain moments. It's not a fun place to be, but knowing that there's something on the other side is what kept me going.
Yeah, that kind of brings me to this idea of, you know, if you are feeling burnout, if you are feeling some sort of shortcoming in the culture, how do we communicate that to leadership? What's like a good way to kind of be able to say, hey, I'm struggling with this in a way that's productive?
I think Tanya and I have very similar advice. Mm-hmm. And Tanya, please build on what I'm about to say, but take the perspective of leadership before you walk into the room and want to start telling them all the things you're struggling with. And this is where my passion for knowing how a business works comes into play when you're an emerging professional, when you start talking about things that you're struggling with. You know, a manager wants you to come to them with some solutions as well if you're struggling with something. So even if you come to them with, you know, hey, I have this problem, but here are three things that I think might help with this situation. It's always good to come with a solution if you're also going to come with a challenge or a problem. So, Tanya, what do you think?
Yeah, that's the main thing, is to bring solutions. And I think you need to rehearse how you're going to say it, because coming in and saying, this is the problem and this is what we should do, is probably not going to sit well with that leader, because you have to take things from their perspective as well. And usually they may have put a lot of work into how things are right now. And so it's kind of a bit personal to them. And approaching it in a little more delicate way, as far as saying, hey, I noticed this, or I'm hearing this. Have we thought about approaching it a little differently? Or have we thought about approaching it this way or doing it this way? Rather than saying we should, have we, make it more about you and the leader rather than just your own idea.
Yeah, it's not about one person. It's really about everyone. I mean, that's really what culture is. So the leader kind of has to see kind of the 30,000, you know, foot view of what's going on with everyone. I mean, it's not a one size fit all solution, but I mean, there is kind of the idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion, in that some people may be having very specific issues that are very specific to them. And kind of how do we address those as well?
I would say, too, it's important to get feedback from others, because if it's just you feeling that way, then maybe you need to look internally before approaching that leader. And getting feedback from others, not to stir up trouble or create drama or anything like that, but just kind of see how others are feeling and if it is just you or if there are others that, you know, think things need to change as well.
And I think approaching, if you can also talk to your peers and help understand what else other people might be struggling with, in addition to approaching leadership, having taken their perspective, having putting yourself in their shoes for a hot minute, coming with a sense of curiosity too about what are some of the things at the firm that you might not, you know, have a lot of knowledge about or privy to that might be impacting what you're struggling with. Coming at it with a sense of wanting to be educated on some of the conditions or the systemic things that you might not see on a day-to-day basis that are informing your experience is advice that I would offer too. And I think we have a hard time approaching leadership sometimes too from an emerging professional's perspective, because we do see, you know, these power dynamics that exist, and you think that it might work the same way as a family system. And workplace does sometimes work similar to a family system, but it's different in that, you know, there's not a parent that's, you know, coming down with discipline. And it's just a different environment where you have more autonomy to make suggestions or offer solutions in a way that will be well received across the board. Yeah, I definitely learned this lesson the hard way myself. So shout out to all the leaders that helped me navigate being someone who could bring solutions. You know who you are.
The real MVPs.
Yes.
But I would say those who are intimidated about approaching leaders, that remember, they're humans too, and they make mistakes. And that servant leadership that I talked about, if they have the right mindset, they're mm-hmm. going to be open to those solutions as long as you're presenting them in the right way.
Yeah. And I think there's a difference between putting our leaders up on a pedestal and respecting them and the responsibility that they carry in the firm. There's a big difference.
So kind of on the other side of the coin, kind of from maybe how individuals are communicating to leadership, how can leadership sort of successfully address shortcomings in workplace culture? What can they really be doing to make sure that they're kind of fostering that?
The biggest thing that sticks out to me there is, and it was actually a quote, and I won't get it exactly right, but it was from the Equitable Practice Guide, and it was about the biggest mistake you could make is continuing to do the things because that's just the way they are. That's the way we've always done them. That mindset is one of the biggest mistakes you can make because our workforce is changing so much and the expectations of the workforce is changing. And creating that environment where there's diversity, inclusion, belonging cannot exist with that mindset. And I think that's where companies can make the biggest mistake of, hey, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Well, it may not be broken, but there may be a much better way of approaching situations or doing things.
Yeah. And I think I'll build on that. I think that leadership has to be cognizant that their experience within the firm is very different from the experience of an emerging professional or a staff that's entry level. When we did the foresight exercise as a AIA Middle Tennessee chapter back in 2018, 2019 with, at the time, newly formed Women in Architecture Committee, the exercise that we leaned on to get feedback from the entire region, the first step was seeking and listening. And I think another one of those like 101 mistakes that you can make along with thinking that things should just continue, if it's not broke, why fix it, is making change without seeking the perspectives and interests of the folks who the decisions you make are going to impact. So who are your stakeholders? How can you listen to them? How can you get feedback? Because they might point out something to a leader that this leader didn't even know existed, didn't even think was a problem. And so that stakeholder engagement before making any changes, I think, is so important too. And again, I will say, no matter what size firm you are, that applies.
Yeah, I think I love this conversation around sort of innovation and that we really have to sort of adapt our mindset in a way because we need new ideas. We have a lot of new problems that are happening every day and we need innovative solutions to understand how to solve them. We really have to be willing to be sort of uncomfortable and unfamiliar with what's happening, but being willing to address it and meet it where it is. Kind of going along with that, I would love to ask you, as our work environments kind of start to change and become more complex, I'm thinking work from home, we have a lot new groups that are coming. It's not just architecture, it could be interiors, engineering, all of those things. There are new roles that are existing today that didn't exist yesterday. How can we sort of start to adapt our cultures in a way to be able to ensure that they hold their continuity?
I would love to hear, Tanya, what a large firm is doing about maybe specifically hybrid work environments, since that's really a hot topic right now, and maybe through the lens of an emerging professional or a team lead.
Well, it's making sure that individuals at all levels in the firm are coming to the office on a regular basis. We're on a 3-day hybrid schedule. So because if only emerging professionals are coming, then who's mentoring them? So it's ensuring that everyone is adhering to that, but it's giving people a reason to want to be there, that collaboration that you get, that teamwork that you get. And also, yes, the free pizza. You would be surprised how much people love their free food. I mean, anytime we offer free food in the office, it's a packed house that day, believe it or not.
You're not wrong.
We also make sure leadership is visiting all of our office locations because when that happens, more people tend to want to be in the office to get that interaction. And so making sure we're present in all of the locations and just making it fun. Our CEO always says, hey, I want everyone here to have fun at work. And so not driving, you have to be billable, billable, billable. No, I mean, that's important, yes, but we also make time for fun. And lastly, I would say what people are passionate about, whether that's a nonprofit, doing service days in the community. We do that as groups or as offices. And that gets people in the office part of the day. And then you all go volunteer in the afternoon. So just being creative in the types of things that we're doing in the office and the things that we're offering from a social aspect as well.
The thing that kept me coming into the office, and honestly, I struggled very much at the beginning of the pandemic when I missed out on this, my most recent practice, was the sense of community. I wanted to come to work. I wanted to spend time with the people that I worked with. And I think also being visible, if you're an emerging professional that wants to make waves in your firm and move up, visibility is really important. And it's hard to be visible on the screen. You know, it's not impossible. You have to, it takes a little bit more effort. Being visible is important. Having ad hoc and spontaneous connections with people in the break room is important. I love this anecdote about a young person that I recently worked with, and he was just a sponge. And, you know, this kid is on a rocket ship to the top. And I remember anytime I would get off the phone with a cost estimator or a contractor after having a tough conversation, you know, he was listening. And that's impressive when you're a project manager or even mid-career leader in your firm and there's someone that you're responsible for delegating to that is paying attention to what you're saying on the phone and asking you follow-up questions about vocabulary that he heard. Or he asked me one time about project delivery methods. What's the difference between design build and design bid build? And, you know, he hadn't heard that in school yet. And so he was asking me about it. And being able to look over at somebody when you're in the office and ask those questions is really important. And it creates that visibility and it shows that you're curious. It shows that you want to be good at your job. And that's extremely important if you're an emerging professional that's wanting to make an impact and be seen by folks who can help you move forward.
Tanya, I kind of want you to maybe look back and maybe provide some advice to yourself and sort of what you would tell yourself entering the industry as emerging professional. What kind of stands out now that you wish you maybe would have known back then?
So many things. And it's been a while. So no, I won't say how long. Tell my age here. The first thing I would say is be okay with taking risk. And what I mean by that is, when I was an early professional, I was offered the opportunity to do some different types of roles within HR. And from an architecture perspective, that would be maybe working on different types of projects. And I would just encourage you to do that. Even if you think, no, I know I want to be an architect and I want to work on this specific type of project or design in this specific type of way, that you be open to working on other types of projects, whether it be hospitals or whatever. And even if you decide to come back to what your original passion was, it makes you a better overall professional. And so being willing to take risk in taking on other opportunities outside of what you think you may want to do, because I have seen individuals do that and end up loving it and staying that path. So that's number one. Number two, it's okay to make mistakes. I tried to be a perfectionist and no one is perfect. So not only being okay to make mistakes, but learning from those. So I have tried to absolutely still make mistakes today, of course, and learning from those mistakes, taking that information and making myself a better professional. And lastly, money is not everything. While I know right out of college, you have a lot of student loan debt and, you know, bills to pay and things like that. So money is important, but it's not everything. And with as competitive as the industry is right now, you know, there's a lot of offers going on out there. Don't make a decision based on the money. Make sure it's the right fit for you. Look at that culture, get to know the supervisor, and make the best decision from that perspective.
Love that. That's great advice. Yeah.
I could absolutely keep going all day on that.
Money is not everything. I mean, certainly now I think even today, a lot of people are looking at that priority list and money is often not at the top. It is very important for folks to have work-life balance and to make sure that they do belong where they are and that they're not just fitting in. They really are a part of the culture and a part of that firm. Yeah. Rachel, what do you think?
I think it goes back to that self-awareness piece of when you're looking for a place to work, knowing what you want, knowing, you know, specific to me in my career stage, what are the things that I need to be successful? Knowing thyself and being able to formulate questions to get to the bottom of something in a work culture before you take that on. I would give that advice to emerging professionals. It can sometimes be hard to feel the courage to ask those questions, but a firm is expecting them. A firm is expecting you to return hard questions. And depending on how readily they answer them can tell you, you know, have they thought about it? Do they know, you know, how you will exist here based on what your needs and your wants are? Or, you know, are they kind of out to lunch? Do they not know how to answer them? And that can even give you an idea as well.
I always look for, and I give, you know, stars to people who ask difficult questions. Mm. I appreciate that. And so, if they don't ask any questions at all, I wonder if they're really interested in the position and want it. So that's great advice.
Yeah.
So Rachel, we asked Tanya to look back and now we're going to ask you maybe to look forward and think about what advice you might give to your future self as an even more established leader.
I think as a result of where I currently am in my career and being on the recovery side of burnout, I would tell myself, you know, a couple of days from retirement, just a little reminder of, look how far we've come. I think that this profession is full of a lot of folks that are very ambitious, very talented, really hungry to make an impact. And sometimes we forget to look back. Sometimes we forget to reflect on how much we've learned and what we can do now that we couldn't do a year ago. And the learning curve is so steep and we're learning so fast that, again, it's difficult to pause for a second and say, you know what? I am a better architect now than I was 6 months ago, 12 months ago. And I'm particularly guilty of that. I feel like the only time I really take a minute to stop and reflect is when I'm like brushing off my resume for an award application or, you know, coming to sit on a podcast where I'm like, oh yeah, why did they want me to come here? Oh, that's right. I did these cool things.
Yeah,
so yeah, it's important to just make sure if you're running at 1,000 miles an hour that you take a second to slow down and look how far you've come. So I imagine that I will be in that place, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, just in the thick of it on a day to day and needing to remind myself, look how far we've come.
And I would say, I mean, even 25 years in at this point, I did say it. that never stops. I am constantly having to have pep talks with myself or to remind myself, hey, pick your battles. Is this really that big of a deal? Don't let yourself get so worked up. Don't sweat the small stuff. So it never stops. I would just challenge anyone, no matter where you are in your career, to always keep challenging yourself and always think about looking forward. What advice would I give myself? Am I really handling this effectively? Is this really that big of a deal?
That's fantastic advice.
I love that advice. I'm going to take that in my pocket.
Same.
Walk out of here with that one.
Okay. Are there any resources that y'all would like to plug or talk about?
I would love to plug a few resources from the AIA if I could. It's an AIA podcast. I'm working for the AIA right now. And I think these resources very specifically can help emerging professionals in their quest for a work culture that works for them. Or if they find themselves in a work culture that they would like to improve, you know, what are some things what are some resources that they can look back on to get some ideas? And the firm survey report, the compensation report, and the guides for equitable practice are three things that are fairly easily accessible. The firm survey report and the compensation report do cost some money, but sometimes you can reach out to your local AIA chapter and they can have copies for you to review at their office. There's that. And then anyone who's looking to sort of dig in a little bit more to the nerdy stuff that I love, which is, you know, looking into organizational structures and hierarchies and how those might impact your daily experience of your firm, you can head to my website, rrgresham.com, and you'll find that research there.
Well, and I would just echo the AIA surveys as a firm and as a human resources professional, it's so valuable in looking at if you have the right headcount from a corporate services or support services type perspective and making sure that you're being competitive in the market from a compensation perspective. So valuable those surveys are. And from the equitable practice, I actually was not familiar with those until before this podcast, and they are wonderful. So they are wonderful resources for anyone in a company just looking for ideas on how to approach culture or how to approach DEIB or anything like that. Those are very valuable resources.
And go to conference. Go to AIA conference if you can swing it. Ask your firm if they'll send you Women's Leadership Summit, which is in October. That conference is often focused on DEI items, cultural items. You'll find lots of peers there as well. Your local conferences, so Tennessee, AIA Tennessee puts on a conference every year that changes locations across the state. Get out there, meet people. It's important to make connections with other folks in your area, in your state. Find common interests, find common causes that you care about, recruit allies to the things that you care about, and network, network, network as a young person. It's all about who you know a lot of times.
Yeah, and I really see AIA as the rising tide that lifts all of our ships. But if your ship is not in the water, it's not going to rise.
That's right.
So kind of being a part of those conversations in those sort of courses that really talk about what we're all doing as a profession together, not on our own.
And I think it's important to recognize that no one's going to put your ship in the water for you, that you got to want to put your ship in the water too.
Absolutely.
And I would just say from a leadership perspective, Brené Brown is a wonderful author, Dare to Lead. And we talked about earlier that everyone's a leader in some type of way. So getting familiar with those concepts is key. She has several books, but that one is my favorite. And then other leadership type resources, anything you can really get your hands on that is going to educate you on workplace culture, how to be effective in the workplace, I would just encourage.
Absolutely.
I have a great one for that, Tanya. It's How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. It is fantastic. It stands the test of time. It's over 100 years old now. And a lot of the resources that you find on leadership simply are a regurgitation of that book. It's delightful to read. Some things haven't aged well, but I think the publication is working on that. But that was a life-changing book for me. And, you know, some of the things that Dale Carnegie talks about in the book just sound like, well, this is just what you need to do to be a good human. But then some of the other things he talks about are, you know, very tiny details of what it takes to be a leader and what it takes to be successful. And you're like, oh, I hadn't considered that. But this one tiny thing that I could change, like instead of saying, sorry, I'm late, thank you for waiting. Tiny little changes like that can take you so far. So I would recommend that book to go along with your advice, Tanya.
Okay, so to finish us out, we thought we would do kind of a little fun rapid fire round. It does not have to be that rapid, but we'll kind of, we have four questions. We'll just ask and see where we go. Okay, what's the most unexpected skill you've gained in your career? Tanya, you haven't jumped into Revit yet?
Oh, no. Although one of our leaders who is an architect was like, wow, you're pretty knowledgeable. And I'm like, yeah, just enough to be dangerous.
Careful.
Because I've been in the industry just long enough that I can talk the talk. But if you put me on Revit, I would not have a clue where to start. So.
I think a skill that I've gleaned that surprises me just looking back is diplomacy. I think that coming up, I was very maybe too honest as a young person, had no filter, and I've been able to sort of change that strength of mine about being transparent about the things that I think and feel. And I've been able to massage that over the years to cultivate diplomacy when it comes to expressing how I think and feel, especially in the workplace.
What would you be doing now if you hadn't chosen the career that you did?
I would go to culinary school.
Oh, ooh. You like to cook?
I do. Yeah. I used to. I don't have time anymore.
Sure.
But I just, yeah, it's something I enjoy. And I think really it's become such an art form, and the things that they do with food now is so amazing that I would love to spend time learning that.
Great. We're coming to your house for dinner tonight, right, Tanya?
Oh, I didn't say I was great at it. I would need to go to school. I just think it's fun.
Great.
You know, recently I did hear that someone said the closest profession to architecture is like a chef in a kitchen.
Ooh, tell me more.
Ooh, yeah. I mean, you can just, if you've ever seen like The Bear or TV shows about, yeah, like, or Hell's Kitchen or something, you know.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, you can think about sort of maybe some of the toxicity happening in that environment that may translate to architecture, and sort of you having like these mentors that you really idolize and look up to, and then also sort of just the work ethic and the burnout. But there's an insane amount of creativity that goes with it, and innovation and design. Yeah. And so I thought that was a really interesting comparison.
It also has similarities in sort of the rules of how to create. So like certain flavors go together, and, you know, food has to be a certain temperature so you don't harm someone. So they have a health, safety, welfare aspect to what they do too, that they have to balance with their creativity. So that's interesting. Me, I would be a ballerina, hands down. That was plan A. Architecture was plan B. When I was 14, I was pulled aside by the artistic director of the company that I used to dance for, me and my parents. And, you know, she started it out with, if Rachel wants to be a professional ballerina, then she needs to be dancing in New York. She needs to go to summer intensives, which are, you know, week-long camps that you go to at larger companies around the country. And my parents said, no, she's going to go get her undergraduate. And that was it. It was the shortest meeting about my future I've ever been a part of. If we'd had the resources, if the internet had been a thing, you know, 14-year-old Rachel would have figured out a way to get to those intensives and said, you know what, I'm doing this instead. But I still find ways to get my dance outlet in. Started a ballet company in college with some friends, fellow bun heads is what we call ourselves. And then I'm going country line dancing with my gal pals tonight. And, you know, my Instagram is full with ballet, so I'm still connected to it. But yeah, that's an easy one for me.
Amazing. Okay, we'll end on this one. Do you have a favorite book or resource for inspiration, if you have not already shared one?
I don't know if it's for inspiration. Outside of work, I read so much material to just keep up to speed on all the regulation and leadership qualities, that Nicholas Sparks books are what I just like to decompress on, because it doesn't require a lot of thought. Romantic, usually good stories.
Yeah. So, when you use your brain all day, sometimes it's just so nice to go home and turn it off.
Yes.
And just be able to kind of decompress in a whole different way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think this answer is pretty indicative of my burnout recovery status right now too. And I tell you what, those Nicholas Sparks books really do the trick. When I first graduated from business school, I was planning on reading all these nonfiction books about business to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to continue my education with all these cool books and authors and things. And about a week out of graduation, I took a look at that stack of books that are titled things like Simply Communicated and Built to Last and, you know, how their company can, you know, go from good to great. And I was just like, oh my God, I can't with another one. And so I put myself on a no nonfiction ban for a while. And guess what rose to the top? It was Nicholas Sparks.
Wait, really? I love this connection
really,
point.
Really? And his stories are great for that because they're such, you know, cute and emotional stories at times. And you can relate to the characters and just the setting of North Carolina beaches and things like that. It's always so idyllic and you can really escape there. So I'm actually looking for ways to get myself inspired these days because of the burnout, trying to kind of rediscover what inspires me, and getting reconnected with dance is one of those things. I was also an artist growing up, so I've picked up my pencils and trying to rediscover those creative outlets now that I'm not in traditional practice. I can return to them with a little bit of a different eye, a little bit of a different lens. That's just different than it was when I was practicing. Because like you said, Brittany, at the end of the day, sometimes you just want to turn your brain off, and creativity requires you to have your brain on. So getting the levels of rest that I'm getting that I didn't used to is opening up some cognitive space for me to re-explore those things. And then alongside with the burnout recovery and seeking inspiration, I'm doing a lot of research and homework on how the brain works and how your brain and your body and your diet and your hormones and how all of that is interconnected. And I feel like knowledge is power in that regard. And the more you know about how your body and your mind work together, I think that's going to accelerate my road to burnout recovery in a really big way. So that's helping.
Something she said, though, that is resonating with me is the burnout recovery and it not happening overnight.
Yes.
Because I think when people recognize it, they think they can correct it just like that. And I mean, I don't know how far out you are from it, but it sounds like it's been a very challenging process. So I think people have to recognize and appreciate that and give themselves some grace that, okay, I recognize this is an issue, but it's not going to fix itself overnight. And it's going to be a while before I can get back to the right spot.
Totally. Thanks for seeing that, Tanya. And to tie it back to our conversation about work culture, the culture that I came from where I was burnt out was strong. You can get burnt out in a culture that you like. You can get burnt out in a culture that is nurturing you and helping you. It's this grueling profession that oftentimes just, no matter how supported you feel, it's gonna happen. And it's disappointing. And yeah, it's gonna take time. And I think it's almost encouraging to hear that to read that burnout can take, you know, 1 to 3 years to recover from, because if it was like, oh, you know, it'll take you a week to, you know, recover, I would be so discouraged. And yeah, it has been hard to try and find that grace for myself. So thank you for seeing that, Tanya.
Well, this has been amazing. You both are such an inspiration, honestly. And thank you for being here, for talking to us. I know there's going to be a lot of people out there listening to this that feel inspired by everything you've said. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us, Brittany.
Thank you. It was fun.
Yes. Loved it. All right. Until next time. This has been a production of AI Middle Tennessee. To learn more about AI membership or other upcoming programs or events, visit aiamidtn.org or find us on social media at aiamidtn. To reference and read the AIA Guides for Equitable Practice, please visit the Resource Center at aia.org. If you have questions or comments regarding this episode, please reach out on social media at re_formtn.
Today's episode is brought to you from The Russell, a historic East Nashville church transformed into a one-of-a-kind boutique hotel. The Russell's mission is to give back to the Nashville community through their Rooms for Rooms program by donating a portion of each stay to local nonprofits who are helping those experiencing homelessness. Visit russellnashville.com to book your experience today.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to having you for the next.